Let's close the eyes. Sitting up comfortably tall, relaxed. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. Okay. Softly open the eyes. Welcome. No, we'll just sign in, just so we know who's present. And this, like I said, today we have more newcomers. So just to give you a brief introduction of what we're doing here. This is a study of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Okay, and any study of Patanjali or the Yoga Sutras, we normally start with a little invocation. It's kind of a invocation to recognize the greatness of Patanjali. So this is what we will recite. Okay, you can either read and sing along with me, or you can just close the eyes and listen in. Okay, so you can inhale. Yogena chittasya padena vacha malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarotam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And Sajani, you want to read the English translation loud?
Yeah, I didn't bring my glasses.
Okay, hold on a second then. Let Jyoti do that.
Me either. I don't have my glasses either.
I think I can bring you. I can even see.
Oh.
Okay.
Supriya?
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the Muni's sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, Patanjala
Mahabhashya,
and the impurities of the citta, mind field, through his treatise on yoga, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
Very good. So, as you can see, Patanjali is given the credit for three of the most important areas of human life, which is physical health, mental health, and health of the speech. So, some historians believe it was the work of three people by the same name, Patanjali. Some believe it's the same person. Who knows? Doesn't matter. Okay. So, just a very brief kind of an introduction so you get up to speed. Yoga Sutras is a text which has four chapters. First of all, Yoga Sutras. What is Yoga Sutras? Have you read anything about it at all? Not at all. Okay. It's a very ancient text, and it tells us all about the concepts of yoga. What is yoga? What is the basic underlying philosophy of yoga? What are the methodologies? what are the objectives of yoga and what are the techniques and methodologies to attain those objectives of yoga. Okay? So, this text has four chapters. The first chapter contains the very definition of yoga. Definition of yoga and then of the, you know, the states of the mind eventually leading to the state of samadhi. So it talks a lot about the state of samadhi, which is the final state of the mind when you are in deep states of meditation. And it tells you what the different stages of meditation are. Okay, so that's the first chapter. The second chapter starts with a discussion of what Patanjali calls klesha, which in modern terminology you can translate as stress, basically. What is klesha? Suffering, pain, mental pain, agony, and stress. What causes it? What are the causes of this stress? And then how to eliminate that stress, how to eliminate the suffering from the mind so that your mind can become very peaceful. And keeping or making the mind peaceful is the objective of yoga, making the mind peaceful. Remember, we said here that the Patanjali is given the credit for Yoga Sutras for the purpose of cleansing the impurities of the chitta or the mind field through his treatise on yoga. Okay? Alright, so that's the purpose of yoga, to clean the mind of all the impurities. And in the second chapter, he starts the discussion on what's now called the eight limbs of yoga. Well, it's called the eight limbs of yoga, Ashtanga Yoga. Okay, eight limbs of yoga, and some of you might have heard these eight limbs, yamas, niyamas, etc. Okay, the third chapter is mostly related to meditation, and through the practice of meditation, what kind of supernormal or supernatural powers that you can attain. Things like becoming very light, becoming very heavy, small, big, being transparent, being opaque, etc., etc. You know, lots of different supernormal powers that one can attain through a deep state of meditation. Meditation on different aspects of us, of our being. Okay, you can meditate on different things to become proficient in something or the other. Okay, that's chapter 3. Chapter 4 goes deeper into the state of final state of meditation. Patanjali calls it the state of Kaivalya. Kaivalya means that at that point you have realized, or you're about to realize your true identity, your true essence of your being, which means that we now have attained what's called the state of self-realization. Have you heard the term self-realization?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Knowing yourself.
Knowing yourself. That means as of now we don't know ourselves. That's the whole point, right? We don't know reality of ourselves. We know who we are. I mean, we think this is what we are. I mean, we have a physical body, we have a mind, we have a thinking capability, and that's what we are. But that's exactly the untruth. The truth is something beyond that. And that what is beyond that untruth, which is the truth, that's the whole objective of the practice of yoga. Okay? How to get there. Right? So what we did, this is right now in the middle of that whole session that we started almost a year ago now, roughly. I don't recall when. So we've been going through sutras, one sutra at a time. Okay, there are a total of 195 sutras. We don't cover every one of them, no. We just cover maybe 50, 60 total, you know, maybe a little more actually. So we covered chapter 1 and 2 in fair amount of detail. Chapter 3, the beginning part, just the meditation part. And that's pretty much all we cover. We don't go to chapter 4, that's much deeper. Man. Even what we're going to talk about today, where we left off last session, it's a fairly deep topic. So feel free to stop me if I There are things in this, in what this discussion that we are going to do today, even I don't fully understand. So I'm going to just share with you my, what I know, and share with you my own ignorance as well. Okay? So it's all, we'll try to do it all together then. So we have been doing this whole aspect of what's called the eight limbs of yoga. That's what we have been doing recently. Recently, meaning the last 6 months or so, maybe more. What are the eight limbs of yoga? Anybody know the eight limbs of yoga? Yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Okay. Yamas and niyamas are, there are five yamas and five niyamas. They represent the ethical, moral, and social guidelines. How to deal with other people, how to discipline yourself, how to behave in society. There are things like never telling a lie, never hurting anybody, never stealing anything, don't be greedy, etc., etc. Kalpana. So these are the 10 guidelines for living in a manner that eventually will lead to a very calm and peaceful mind. Because if you never tell a lie, if you never hurt anybody, you'll be peaceful. If you hurt somebody, you'll never be peaceful. All right, you'll always be thinking about that, etc., etc. So these are the 10 guidelines, 5 yamas and 5 niyamas. They form sort of the foundation of the whole practice of yoga. I mean, you can be a very flexible person, right? You can bend your body into the shape of a pretzel. You know, you're so flexible, you're very strong, you can go into the Chaturanga Dandasana and stay there for 10 minutes, etc. All that is possible. But if your mind is unclean, if you do not follow the yamas and niyamas, you tell lies all the time, you hurt others, that strength, flexibility of no use. It's not going to get you anywhere. Nowhere. It cannot get you anywhere. Right? So that's why yamas and niyamas are a very strong foundation for a good yoga experience. Then the third limb is asana, which is the... What's asana mean? What does asana mean?
Posture.
What kind of posture? Asana literally means a sitting posture, seated posture. You sit in something, sit in a chair or sit on the floor or on a bench or whatever, but sitting posture is asana. It comes from, most of the words in Sanskrit are derived from the root words, and the root word for asana is as, which means to sit. As means to sit, okay? So, he's sitting, that means saha asate, that will be the sentence. That means he is sitting. Okay. All right, so sitting posture is what asana means. And Patanjali gives the definition of that sitting posture. He says it should be sthira and sukham. Sthira means very firm and steady. That means when you're sitting for meditation, you should have a firm, nice and stable posture, not trembling, not shaking, not moving, and very comfortable. You should not feel any kind of pain or discomfort. That's asana. But as things have evolved, people realize the need for physical postures also, you know, all the physical stretching, because they said without that, you cannot even sit for 10 minutes. If the body is not strong and flexible, you sit there for 10 minutes, everything hurts. You cannot sit there. So when they developed all these physical postures, like standing postures, sitting postures, inverted and reclining and everything, instead of coining a new name, they said, we'll call everything asana. So asana is now extended in meaning to include all the postures that we know of. Okay? That's asana. Then the next limb of the eight limbs of yoga is pranayama. What's pranayama?
Control
of breathing. Breathing practices. Breathing practices which involved a variety of variations that you can bring about to your breathing sequence. We breathe normally in and out all the time, 24 hours. But how can you vary that breath in multiple ways? That becomes pranayama. Okay. What's the limb number 5? Pratyahara. Pratyahara. What does it mean? Pratyahara means to withdraw the senses. 5 senses we have, right? So withdraw them from any outside influence. Senses are always attracted to outside things. You hear something, you see something, smell something, you touch something, etc., etc. All these are external to us. Most of the attractions are external to us for our 5 senses. And how we can withdraw these 5 senses from their objects of attraction. Okay, that's called pratyahara. Pratyahara is the sense withdrawal. Then the last 3 limbs of yoga, they all relate to meditation. Last 3 limbs of yoga. What are the last 3 limbs of yoga? Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi. What is Dharana? Dharana is the ability to focus your mind on something. You know, you need something to initially kind of focus your mind, concentrate your mind on so that it doesn't run away all the time then, okay? So there's an initial state of focus that you want to bring your mind to. That's called dharana. And there are a variety of techniques that people have presented to get into that state of dharana or to practice the state of dharana. Once you have practiced dharana for some time, that's when you transition to this next stage of meditation called dhyana. And the term in English for dhyana is meditation. Okay, so you can think of dharana as focus in English and dhyana as meditation. Okay, and when the meditation becomes very deep, then you start getting into a state of samadhi. Okay? State of samadhi. Samadhi is the final kind of absorption, you can call it, or total engrossment in whatever you are focusing on. Total engrossment. No mental fluctuations at that time. So those are the 8 limbs of yoga called the Ashtanga yoga. Ashta means 8. Anga means the limbs. Anga means the limbs. 8 limbs of yoga. And we have been in the last, I think, 2 or 3 sessions, we have been discussing the last 3 limbs called the limbs of meditation. Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. All right? So, since all of you are new, what I think I'll do is to kind of very, very quickly go through each sutra that we went through so far. Very quickly, I don't want to dwell on any one of them. Otherwise, we'll be going backwards. Okay? But it makes sense for at least because all of you are new today. Well, except Kalpana. You've been here.
The last couple of times. But...
Yeah, but you've been here before. And of course, Laura has been here for a long time.
I think I missed the last 1 or 2 of these too.
So you're also
new to this. Discussion.
So this is new for everybody then. Maybe I should spend more time then. Okay. And Laura has started memorizing all the sutras, and she has done chapter 1 already. I think 50.
Or 50.
40.
Not quite chapter 1.
Okay. She has memorized all the sutras in Sanskrit.
Where do you find them?
Probably online, right? Available online as well.
No, you go to my website, you find everything. There are lots of books that we can use.
Yeah, I bought that.
Yeah, that's a good book to start. That's a very good book to start. And okay, so we've been focusing on meditation. So what happens is when you start studying these sutras, the sutras become obviously a little more involved as they go deeper into the states of meditation. Okay? Every state of meditation gets you a different experience, different awareness. And since most of us, none of us actually maybe, has been there, it becomes a little bit hard to understand these sutras, okay? So that's what I said, you know, that I may not be able to explain everything in these sutras, but we will give it a try. Alright? At least we'll go through the Sanskrit words, their English translation, and a general kind of a flow of the meaning of the sutras. Okay? As to the in-depth meaning, I don't know. I'm not there yet. Okay?
That's left for everyone to interpret. That's usually what others interpret in their own way, right? After
everything. Explain, yeah. Everyone interprets it in their own way because their own experiences will come into the play, right? Now before we go into this,
the power went off because.
Oh. This has never happened before, right? Why would the power go off?
It went into screensaver mode, so then there was nothing transmitted.
Not sure if that. Anyway, so can also just sign in. You know, before we go into the discussion of the states of meditation, stages of meditation, it's always a good idea to understand. This is from one of the commentaries by Vyasa. He says that you can think of the mind as being in one of these five states. So he calls them the five states of the mind. Okay? So the first state he calls it is the Kshipta state. Kshipta in Sanskrit means all over the place. That means the mind is thinking of this thing at this moment and the next thing at the next moment and running around completely scattered all over the place. All right? And that's the state that we are almost always in when we are in the waking state. Scattered mind, completely disturbed mind, agitated mind, we are always chattering with ourselves. You know, that's the kind of mind that we have. And, you know, if you think of the three gunas, does everyone know what three gunas are? Three gunas? No. Sattva, sattva, rajas and tamas, or tama or raja, you know, that's sattva, rajas and tamas. Sattva is the purity or, you know, something positive, something clean. That's sattva. And rajas is more of action, movement, you know, that what they call type A personality in a mental sense. And tamas is something very, very dull, very sleepy, dull, lethargic, inactive, negative, all that is sattva, tamas. So the states of the mind are constantly changing because these three gunas keep changing all the time. That's how they tell us. These three gunas are in a state of flux all the time, constantly, and therefore the state of the mind keeps changing. Okay? You know, you I'm just picking an example here. If you came here, maybe they were driven by sattva a little more, okay, a little more positive thoughts, positive feelings. And then sattva was dominant. And then you use a little bit of rajas to activate your body and come here, okay? Everything is needed, right? But then you're sitting here and listening to me for a long time, and then suddenly tamas takes over and you fall asleep. That can happen. That can happen, you know. I'm just giving you the play of these gunas. It can happen anytime, anywhere. And they always intermingle, intermix, and influence each other in multiple ways. So when the mind is kshipta, it's not the sattva mind at that time. It's always it's called the rajasic mind or the tamasic mind. Okay? Rajasic mind will take your mind all over the place. It's action, movement. Okay? So kshipta is the first state. What's the next state? Moodha. What is moodha? Moodha is completely deluded, completely confused. You're not sure what's right, what's wrong. Your mind is going all over the place. And so moodha is the confused state, and translated as sleepy, lethargic, dull, etc., etc. Okay? Then, when you get into a state of meditation and you sit there for some time, your mind can start becoming a little more focused then, at times, okay? You have a moment of focus and then moment of dispersion. Focus, dispersion, focus, dispersion, etc. That's called vikshipta. Vikshipta. Which means partially focused and partially distracted. That's the vikshipta state. And then when you sit and deepen your meditation, then you start getting into a state of a few moments of one-pointedness. That means if you're focusing on some object, you can stay on that focus for a long period of time, for some period of time. That's called ekagrata. Ekagrata is the state of mind where you have attained some level of focus and concentration. And finally, when you are able to completely eliminate all the thought processes, from the mind, which is a state which, you know, probably we will never get there. But that's the goal of yoga, is to get into a state, it's called the niruddha state, where you have attained a total nirodha. The definition of yoga in chapter 1 by Patanjali is chitta vritti nirodha. Chitta vritti nirodha. Chitta is the mind. Vritti is all this fluctuation, all this chatter that we talked about. And nirodha is the ability to completely calm the mind down, completely eliminate all this chatter, all this discussion, the scattering of the mind, etc., etc., and get into a very peaceful, very calm and quiet state of mind. That's called nirodha. So nirodha is the word for it, and the niruddha state, name of the state itself is niruddha state, niruddha, one that has attained the state of nirodha.
Is there any example of anybody who has been in that state, niruddha?
I mean, all these big yogis, they always claim that, you know, like my teacher was Swami Sachidananda, they always say he was in that state. His guru was Swami Shivananda. Okay, they claim he was in that state. Of course, there are common examples of people like Ramana Maharishi and Swami Vivekananda and all these famous yogis, you know, all these people there, they all claim,
There was that on that day, there was a video on WhatsApp, a guy from, I don't know if he was from Africa, in very tall, 6.5 feet guy. It's very popular on WhatsApp, and you can see the video, like he's doing, performing in front of a lot of people, and he bends his body almost like to a very little, almost to a box, and he fits in there and goes underwater, and he can attain then that for few minutes, and he bends his body to like almost like a baby, and he fits in that water box, and it's in front of people. I think it's on a big show, and then he gets out, but he can attain that only for that
Short amount of time.
You know, short time of focus, that kind of a focus and flexibility. And he has been doing yoga, you know, in the true sense.
Well, so that's what it is.
It was amazing to see that how somebody can hold their breath, meaning take his breath to a point where he's not living almost to that kind of attainment.
Yep. It's, all these are possibilities. Absolutely attainable. Okay. So that's the state of the mind which is called niruddha state. Niruddha means that you have finally attained a state where your mind is not scattered, not distracted by anything at all. Okay? So that's the kind of the discussion of the states of the mind. And then dharana, like I said, I'm not going to spend too much time, but let's just quickly go through these definitions of each of these sutras. All right? So dharana is the initial state of focus, where the mind is now able to focus on something. All right, you know, in my yoga classes, you know, for example, I do a practice called the Trataka practice. Trataka means gazing at the candle flame. Anybody done that before?
Yes.
Okay, so candle flame, gazing at the candle flame. Now that becomes the point of focus. Then you focus on that candle flame for a long enough time that the mind eventually settles down. And when you feel the mind has settled down, then you close the eyes and then transition to your mantra meditation. So that's the technique. You know, I have several different techniques of getting into a state of dharana first and then transitioning to your mantra meditation. So that's dharana. Yeah, that's the same thing. Yeah, that's the same thing.
Like you have determined to do something and you get to do it, right?
Yeah. Yep. Focus. You focus your mind on something and then do it.
You do it. Yeah.
Dharana. See? Oh, let me just quickly also pronounce the Sanskrit words here just to give you a flavor of what the Sanskrit sounds are like. So the statement here is desha bandha chittasya dharana. You know, normally what we do is when we go through these sutras one by one, we repeat the Sanskrit after, you know, I'll say it once and then you repeat after me. But this is just a review of these things, okay? So dhyana, again the Sanskrit is tatra pratyaya ekatanata dhyanam. That's the Sanskrit for it. So tatra pratyaya ekatanata. Now, uninterrupted flow of the mind toward one object, that becomes meditation. So when you pick an object, for example, you have a mantra. Most of the time, that's, you know, that most people commonly use a mantra as their object of meditation. Okay? So once you have picked a mantra, if you can stay on that chanting of the mantra for some length of time without being interrupted by any other thought, that state of mind is called meditation. That's called dhyana. All right? Uninterrupted flow of a single object at the, that means the, without any interruption, without any disturbance.
So can you achieve this with the same candle?
Well, not candle is an external object. When we say meditation, then you have to think of an internal object. Okay, because we really want to go deeper into our states of consciousness. Candle will give you initial state of focus. It will bring you some kind of focus to the mind. But it cannot elevate your levels of consciousness.
Does the mantra have to be the same all the time?
All the time. That's recommended. Same mantra should be used all the time. Yes. Good thought. And it has reasons.
Deepak Chopra does those guided meditations on like the 21 day with Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, they change the mantra every day.
Yeah, so that's dharana practice then. Okay. It's not meditation. Okay. That falls in the category of dharana, initial focus. Yeah, you can do that. You can change your mantra every day for dharana practice. But for meditation, for dhyana, it should be the same mantra all the time.
Same
mantras?
Of course. Yeah. You, for you, whatever mantra you pick, you should stay with the same mantra, because it develops very powerful qualities. When you chant the same mantra over and over again, it develops very powerful qualities inside and outside the mind. It has the ability to eventually strike at all the samskaras, all the past impressions that we are trying to eradicate. That's the purpose of yoga. And if you use the same mantra over and over again, it can help you do that. If you keep changing the mantra, then the fields of energy are distracted all the time. You're not able to have the same focus then, same force. So it's important, yes.
Does a guru have to give you the mantra?
Usually that's the tradition, yes. The traditional approach is to go in the service of the guru for a long time. In the old days, it used to be 12 years, right? In 12 years of schooling, in the ancient time, you would go and live in a gurukul or an ashram and serve the guru for 12 years and get the training from him, all aspects of learning. And when you graduated, that's when they gave you a mantra for life.
My parents both got one, but they won't tell me what it is.
They're not supposed to. Once you get a mantra from a guru, it becomes a secret mantra. You're not supposed to tell it to anybody. That's how it is mentioned in our ancient texts. But if you just pick up your own mantra, you can share it with the others. It doesn't matter. Well, these days, most people end up picking their own mantra. Because to find a guru who can give you a mantra is not very easy. Right? So you have to pick one yourself, and then do it. Now, what is samadhi? Tadeva artha matra nirbhasam swarupa shunyam eva samadhihi. That's the Sanskrit phrase. The most important part is artha matra nirbhasam. Artha is the meaning or the essence of what you're meditating on. Artha means the meaning or the essence of what you're meditating on. Matra means just that, nothing else. So what it says is that in the final state of samadhi, the only thing that remains in the mind is the essence of what you're meditating on. The very essence of that, artha matra. Nothing else remains in the mind. Just one concept. Even at that time, the sense that I am meditating, that goes away, because then if that thought is there, it's not the same thing as the object of meditation. You're not even aware that you're meditating. The only thing that's in your mind is the very essence of the object that you're meditating on. Artha matra nirbhasa. That's it. Nothing else remains in the mind. That's the state of samadhi eventually. And then, of course, we're going to go through different stages of samadhi. Okay, that's what Patanjali talks about, the various stages of samadhi. Okay. Then, when you practice all these three successively, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, then Patanjali calls it sanyama. That's the word he uses, sanyama. Sanyama can mean multiple things depending on the context. In our context, sanyama means the concept where we start practicing all these three in a sequence. Dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Okay? That's sanyama. And like I said, in the chapter 3, Patanjali talks about a variety of supernatural powers which can be attained by practicing sanyama on different aspects, different objects. Okay? Okay, so this is where we started going into the different stages of samadhi. So earlier on the first chapter, Patanjali said there are two broad categories of samadhi. Two broad categories. So the first one, he says, it's called sampragnata samadhi. What that means is that in this state or the stage of samadhi, you still have the mind focused on your object of meditation. Okay, so your mind is or still has that object of meditation, whatever your object was. And remember, in the previous sutra we said artha matra, And you still have that same essence or the meaning of that object in your mind at that point. That's called sampragnyata samadhi. But if you're able to transcend that state, okay, when you can transcend that state, if you can suspend the pratyaya, pratyaya is the content of the mind. If you can suspend the pratyaya of the mind, which is the final content that you had, arthamatra, if you can even eliminate that, then the only thing that will remain is some of the impressions that you have, but they are of no use, because there is no content of mind at that point. So what Vyasa, the commentator, says, that the impressions that we have from the past, they become like dead or burnt seeds, he called them, dagdha bija. That's Vyasa's commentary. So they become dagdha bija. That means they don't have any impact on us anymore. And we'll get there sometime. But okay, so that's the definition of the final state of samadhi. Like I said, these are very difficult to understand. Why? Because none of us has been there. You know, we cannot, experientially, we cannot talk about it. I cannot talk about it experientially. I can only talk about it at an intellectual level. Just the way I understand the Sanskrit word, their meaning, and how it is explained by a variety of commentators. You know, you have to read multiple commentaries to understand the essence of these sutras. Okay? Every commentary is different, let me tell you that. And, you know, Laura and I are a part of the study group, and we study four different commentaries, vastly different interpretations. Vastly different. Each sutra, like you said, it's very differently interpreted by different authors. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's very helpful. It all depends what they talk about. Their English translation of each sutra, everybody has a different wording. You will not find two commentators who have translated the same sutra exactly in the same words. Not in one instance. Okay? So, that's the asampragnyata samadhi, or the samadhi where there is no trace of any object. Toward the end of the chapter, he also calls it the nirbija samadhi, seedless. So nirbija means seedless samadhi. Okay? Very last state of the mind. Now, this is another term he introduces called samapatti, which is very similar to samadhi, but he calls it samapatti. Okay? So the Sanskrit is kshinavrittehe abhijatasyeva manehe grihita grahana grahyeshu tatsth tadanjanata samapattihi. Okay, now maybe one of you can read the meaning, English meaning. You want to read, Supriya?
Just as the naturally pure crystal assumes shapes and colors of objects placed near it, so the yogi's mind, with its totally weakened modifications, becomes clear and balanced and attains the state devoid of differentiation between knower, knowable, and knowledge. This culmination of meditation is samadhi. Sutra 1.01.
Now, this may seem a little overwhelming, but what we have to look at is, you know, there are three entities here. One is the knower, the person who is meditating, so to say, the mind. You can think of the intellect as the knower. Okay, the intellect, that's the knower. And the knowable, whatever you are looking at, okay, in a physical sense, if I'm looking at a book, that's the knowable. If I'm looking at Kalpana, she's a knowable, you know, that my senses can perceive, or even my mind can go back into the memory, and then I can look at that, and that becomes the knowable. And then there is the the knowledge itself. You can call it the instrument of knowledge or the knowledge itself. What am I trying to get at? Okay, so the knower, or the it's called the grahitra, grahana, grahyeshu. The technique of, or the instrument of knowledge, the knowledge itself, the knower and the knowable. When they all merge into one entity in the mind, everything merges into one entity. How does it happen? In a very deep state of meditation. How do you understand that? Very hard. Very hard to understand these concepts, like I said, because we're not there. But that's the goal. That's the goal eventually. It's called samapatti. That's the new term he has introduced. Again, shabdarth jnana vikalpaihi sankirna savitarka. Now what he has done is, he has divided this, the initial state of samadhi, into multiple different categories. Okay? Alright, so the categories are, in Sanskrit, the first category is vitarka, second is vichara, third is ananda, fourth is asmita. And then in these sutras we are going to see that he's divided vitarka and vichara into, so vitarka he's divided into two more categories, savitarka and nirvitarka. Again, vichara, savichara and nirvichara. Now what does that mean? He doesn't explain all these things, right? Commentators, it's left to the commentator to explain what that might mean. Patanjali doesn't give you a clue what that means. He just explains, he just writes these things. So what the commentators believe is savitarka, or the vitarka means a gross object, meditation on a gross aspect of the object of meditation, gross. Vichara means meditating on the subtler aspects of the object of meditation. Okay? Gross and subtle. Alright? So what do you mean by gross and subtle? So if I give you a gross example, you know, let's say you are meditating on, what should we say? We used to pick, say, apple, for example. I'm just picking a gross object. Okay, big. If you pick an apple for meditation, just all right. It has gross qualities, right? It has a shape, it has a color, it has a feel, touch, texture. All these are gross qualities. You can focus any one of all of them or any one of them. If you like the color of the apple, you can focus on the color and then, or the touch of it, etc. That has a physical gross aspect, but the moment you go deeper into that, okay, so then you have a, you know, a taste for it, you know, you can taste it also. So the inner aspect of that touch, feel or taste, or that's called the subtle aspect. We're inside. That's called tanmatra in Sanskrit. Tanmatra is these five senses, where their senses now become a subtle aspect. Because the mind is now able to focus only on the taste, for example, not on the apple. The apple, the physical object apple, has gone. What has remained in the mind?
Taste.
Just the feeling of the taste. It could have come from anything. At that point, we don't know it came from an apple. Okay? Do you get the sense of it now? Initially, you knew its color is pink and this and that, you know, it has a shape, it has size, it has texture, a heavy weight or whatever. That's all the physical gross aspect. You can focus on that. But the moment you focus on something subtler, for example, like I said, give the example of taste, then at that point, the only thing that's in your mind is that taste. Not where it came from. Not the other aspects of the apple. Now, so that's the subtle and the gross part. But then he goes into savitarka and nirvitarka. Now those are a little more difficult to understand. Okay, so we'll come into that and then we'll talk about that. But I'm just explaining the four different aspects of it, okay? But then the last two Ananda and Asmita, he doesn't divide them into separate parts. Okay, what's Ananda? Ananda means?
Happiness,
contentment, happiness, total bliss, as they call it. Okay, so again, looking back to that example of apple, once you are focused on the taste for a long time, then you can start getting into a state of ananda. The mind, you're not even thinking of the taste anymore. It gets into a state of bliss, so to say. Okay, that's called ananda state of meditation. We have transcended the gross physical aspect, you've transcended the subtle aspect, and you've gone into a state of total ananda. Okay? And final state of samadhi, of this level of samadhi, is called the asmita. Asmi means I am. Asmita means I am-ness. It's the quality of feeling that I am. And there is a period after that state. It's a full sentence. I am becomes the full sentence. Nothing added after that. It doesn't say I am in a state of bliss. It doesn't say I am happy. It doesn't say I am sad. Nothing of that. You've gone beyond all qualifications, beyond all categorization of who you are, what you are, in what state you are. No. I am. I exist. That's it. And that's the final state of the Samprajnata Samadhi. You get the idea now? All right. So let's briefly go through these quickly just to... Okay. So, tatra shaddarth jnana vikalpaihi sankirna samitarka samadhi. Again, this is very similar to this, the definition that we earlier had. It says that there are three attributes of any object of meditation: shabda, artha, and jnana. Some of you might remember these words. I use them in my classes quite a bit. So every object of meditation has shabda, means the sound or the word itself, shabda, right?
Yes.
So if you pick a mantra, even if you pick a mantra apple, for example, it has a sound and a written word. It's called the shabda. Artha means what?
Meaning.
It's the name of a category of fruit, which is called apple. Okay, so it's a category of fruit. That's the meaning. And jnana means what?
Knowledge.
So knowledge about an apple, where it came from, whether it came from Mexico or where, California, or where did I buy it? I bought it from a store, and all kinds of related information. Okay, it's this variety, it's the golden apple, or this apple, or that. Whatever information, there's going to be a multitude of the kinds of knowledge that your mind already has about an apple or about some specific apple. All that storehouse of information is called jnana. Right? What this sutra says, that when you're able to bring your mind to a state... This is a state of samadhi. That means this is a state of deep concentration. Initially, when you start meditating, the mind goes all over the place. You chant your mantra, Om, apple, 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 apple. Okay? And then it goes to all over the place. You'll be cooking your meals, or you'll be planning a meeting, or you're planning a dinner, or going and having vacation, etc., whatever. Okay? But this says that if you can bring your mind to within the framework of these three attributes, what are the attributes? Shabda, artha, jnana. Shabda, artha, and jnana. That means these three attributes are the word or the sound, the meaning itself, essence of meaning, and all the peripheral knowledge. If you can bring yourself to that sphere, you are in a state of savitarka samadhi. So initially, you attain the state of the early stage of samadhi, gross level of samadhi, you can call it. Okay? Now, nirvitarka smriti parishuddhau swarup shunyeva arthamatra nirbhasa. Same word, arthamatra nirbhasa. Smriti Parishuddho means when your mind is purified of all the past memories, purified of all the past sanskaras. That means they have no more influence on you. No more influence. At that time, you can see clearly the arthamatra, or just the essence of that object of meditation. Nothing else. That's called nirvitarka. In the savitarka, you were confused between all these three attributes, shabda, artha, and jnana. In the nirvitarka, only the artha remains. Nothing else remains. But it's still at the gross level. That's nirvitarka samadhi. Okay? And then he says, etaya eva savichara nirvichara cha sukshma vishaya vyakhyata. What that means is that in the same manner that we discussed the savitarka and nirvitarka, says you can go ahead and understand in your own mind what is savichara and nirvichara. He doesn't describe you. It says exactly the same logic will apply. But now look at the subtle aspect and go to the subtle meaning, the essence at the subtle level. Okay, that becomes the savichara samadhi. Savichara means with subtle meaning, and nirvichara means without that, just the meaning then, at the subtle level. What does subtlety mean? What does subtle level mean?
Which is not very apparent.
Which is not, whatever, in the context of the Yoga Sutras and the Sankhya philosophy, subtle has distinct meanings.
It's an idea. An idea or a thought.
See, this is where we run into that same discussion on the 23 elements of Sankhya philosophy. Okay. Does everyone know what I'm talking about, Sankhya philosophy? No? Okay. So, you know, there are multiple philosophies in India, multiple different schools of thought, you can call them. You know what they are? 6 different schools of thought. Okay. This is a digression, but I think it's essential
to. This is as related to yoga, right?
Yoga,
6 schools of thought.
No, there are 6 schools of thought. It's called Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, Vedanta, Yoga, and Sankhya. There are 6 schools of thought. What I was going to tell you is that yoga, essentially, Patanjali's yoga is based on an older system of philosophy called Sankhya. Sankhya is much older. Okay. Now, in the Sankhya philosophy, what they tell us is that there are 2 entities. 2 entities. One is called the Atma or the soul, and the other is called the Prakriti. The soul is called Purusha. Purusha and Prakriti. Am I going too fast now? You okay?
This is getting interesting.
Because I'm trying to cover a lot of ground in a very short time. All right. So there is the soul and there is the rest of it, which is the material aspect of our being, our body, our mind, our thinking ability, our discriminatory ability, our intellect, our samskaras, our past impressions, they all are a part of
physical
prakriti. All the prakriti, which is the material aspect. And the consciousness, pure consciousness, is called Purusha. Purusha is the soul, Atma. Okay? That's called the soul. Now, what they say is that you have to think of this prakriti as a composite of 23 elements. Okay, and that's at the human level, 23 elements. What are the 23 elements? Let's talk about that quickly. And you will all recognize most of these. I mean, you know all these. Yeah. We start with the intellect first, at the top level. Intellect, you know what intellect is? Buddhi.
Knowledge.
Buddhi is?
Intellect.
Yeah, what does it mean? What does it do?
Knowledge.
Buddhi will...
Tell us
what to do, basically. Discriminatory function. It allows us to make determination of what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, what we should do, what we should not do, what we should avoid, etc. Anything that makes us pick among multiple choices. That's called the intellect. That's at the highest level. Then there is the entity called ahankara. Does everyone know what ahankara is?
Ego.
Ego. That's the ego part. And then ego, then the third item is, on that list is, so buddhi, ahankara and the mind. Manas it's called, manas in Sanskrit, manas. Have you heard the term manas?
Yes.
Mana? Manas or manaha. Okay. So there's the intellect, the ego,
the mind.
Three top level. And beyond that, then we get into the five tanmatras. Tanmatras are the five sense perceptions, the sense of smell, taste, touch, and everything, right? Hearing, etc., sight, hearing. Five sense perceptions. They are called
tanmatra.
Then there are the five, they are called jnanendriyas. For every one of the tanmatras, for every one of the five tanmatras, there is one jnanendriya. For the sense of smell,
nose.
For the sense of hearing, ear. For the sense of sight, eyes. So they are called the jnanendriyas. Jnan means knowledge. So these are the instruments of knowledge. And they get transferred into the five senses eventually, our five sense perceptions, tanmatras. So five tanmatras, five jnanendriyas. Then there are five karmendriyas. Karma means? Karmendriya, action. What are the five karmendriyas? How do we do action? Hands. Hands are required for action, right? That's one set. There are five of them. Hands, feet and legs, arms. Then hands and arms is one. Legs and feet, second one. What else do we need for action? Speech. Tongue. Right? Most damaging action. Tongue can cause the most damaging action, right? Okay, so those three, and then there are two more. One is the organs of elimination. Okay, organs of elimination. And then the fifth one is the organs of procreation. Okay, so we have procreation elements, organs, elimination, hands and feet, and the tongue. So they are called the five karmendriyas, karma, for action. So how many do we have so far? Anybody count?
3 plus 5, 18.
18. So we need five more to make it 23. What are those five? Anybody?
Elements.
Which ones?
Water, air.
Very good. Earth, water, air, fire and ether.
Yeah.
Right? Five elements. They are called the Mahabhuta. They are called the Mahabhuta. They are the five great elements, as they are called. So that's what the whole concept of Prakriti is according to the Sankhya philosophy. 23 elements. Okay, and then beyond that there is the what's called the Mula Prakriti or the Root Prakriti. Manifest Prakriti. Okay, that's number 24. And then, of course, if you add Purusha to it, then it becomes 25. Okay. So, Purusha, Prakriti, and then the 20, they are called the evolutes or the the things that have come as a part of the evolution that we go through. 23 elements. Now, the gross level elements are the five Mahabhutas, they are called the gross level elements. Karma Indriyas are gross. But the Tanmatras, they are considered to be subtle. Because they are at a subtle level. You don't need any gross element once you are at the Tanmatra level. Like I said, if you were focusing on the taste, you don't need the understanding of the apple itself. So you've gone into a subtler aspect. Beyond the Tanmatras, what's more subtle? The mind. Beyond the mind, what's more subtle? Ahankara. The subtlest at that level is the intellect. Intellect is the most subtle of the entities that you can focus on. Okay? So that's what he means here, sukshma vishayatvam alinga paryavasanam. This level of subtleness, you can go from the lowest level of subtleness to the higher level of subtleness, to the highest level of subtleness. What's the highest level of subtleness? It's when you have merged back into what we call the mula prakriti, unmanifest prakriti. That's the meaning of this sutra. It's a tough sutra. It's not easy to understand. Commentators spend a lot of time explaining this sutra. So it's not easy. All right? I'm just quickly going through this. Okay. And all these states of samadhi, all these stages of samadhi, they are called sabija. Sabija means with seed. Why? Because there is still that object of meditation that we started with. That still is there. Nothing else is there. But that's the pure essence of that object still remains. Okay? Therefore, it's called the Sabija Samadhi. And what it says, Nirvichar Vaisharadye Adhyatma Prasadaha. So, what it says that in this state of Nirvichara Samadhi, where you have really attained complete oneness with the object of meditation at the very deepest level. Okay? In that state, adhyatma prasadaha. That means, prasada means blissfulness, total, you know, there's total emptiness of the mind at that point. Supreme, he calls self, the supreme self shines, adhyatma. I don't know if that's a good translation. You know. That means you're able to now get a glimpse of your true nature. That's what it means. Adhyatma means your own self. You are able to get a glimpse of who you are at that point. Alright? So this is how far we went last time. Up to Sutra number 147. Alright? How do you guys feel? Continue? Okay. All right. So the next sutra says, when you are in that state of Nirvichara Samadhi, where your mind has become very peaceful, calm, and without much distraction, then there he says, Ritambhara Tatra Prajna. So now this is the time when we'll start repeating these Sanskrit words, okay? So the first word is Ritambhara.
Ritambhara.
Tatra.
Tatra.
Prajna.
Prajna.
So Ritambhara Tatra Prajna.
Ritambhara Tatra Prajna.
Okay, that's the sutra. Ritam means truth. Ritam means truth. Ritambhara means, bhara means filled with truth. You know, in totality, truth in totality. What is filled with truth? Tatra. Tatra means there, in that state, when we have achieved the state of nirvichara samadhi. What is filled with truth? Prajna. What is prajna? I'm sure you know somebody by the name prajna, right?
Buddhi.
That's right. It's the sharpest state of the buddhi. Prajna, it translates more into wisdom. Okay, where you have now attained a state of ultimate wisdom, in a sense, prajna. And because of all the cleansing that we have done so far, we said smriti parishuddho, that means we cleaned the mind of all the memories and all the past impressions. We have done all cleansing. The mind is very pure at that point. When the mind is very pure, then it is filled with the ultimate truth of life, ritam. See, ritam kind of has, the meaning has evolved from what I read in the commentaries. In the ancient system of the Vedas, okay, the ritam used to mean apparently the cosmic order. That was given the name ritam. Cosmic order means this. That the cosmic order, I'm talking of the cosmic order, which means this earth is rotating, this sun is going, you know, things are happening at a very beautiful, rhythmic manner, and there is a truth behind all that. That was called the rhythm. But slowly the meaning has kind of evolved to just the ultimate truth of being. So that means you are fully aware of the ultimate truth at that point. That your wisdom is full of that ultimate truth because you have cleansed the mind of all the impurities. Your guna, the sattva guna has now become very prominent. The other two gunas, rajas and tamas, have become inactive in a sense, or not as active.
Settled.
So that's the intuitive wisdom, he calls it, containing the highest experience of truth. Now, this truth that we get, we cannot get through other means. This is an experiential truth. Okay, so the sutra is Shruta, let's repeat that, Shruta,
Shruta.
Anumana,
Prajnabhyam,
Anya Vishaya, Visheshartatvat. Let me repeat that one more time. Shruta, Anumana, Prajnabhyam, Anya Vishaya, Visheshartatvat. Okay. Anya Vishaya. Anya means different. So this prajna, this wisdom that we have attained, it's not the same wisdom that you would get from Shruta and Anumana. What does that mean now? Again, these are deep concepts which we have talked about earlier. Shruta means?
Hearing.
Hearing. Hearing from what?
Scriptures.
Scriptures. Yes. Vedas are called Shruti. Vedas are called Shruti.
Reading
the knowledge, right? Very good. So the knowledge or the wisdom that you gain from Shruti, from the scriptural understanding, or from Anumana. What's Anumana?
Guessing.
Inference. Inference based on some of my past experiences. I can infer something based on my past experience. You can get some wisdom, you can get some knowledge. But what he says is, this wisdom that we gain, because it is based on a very special artha. Vishesh artha means because it's a very special artha, very special meaning we have attained through this wisdom. It's very different. You cannot gain that wisdom through Shruti or through Anuman or through inference. That's the meaning of the sutra. Very special wisdom that you have gained here. Through an experience, not through knowledge, not through study, not through discussion. Okay? So that's a very important part of this discussion. This special truth is totally different from knowledge gained by hearing, study of scriptures, or inference. Very good. Okay? So, the next sutra says, let's read this, repeat this. Tajjaha, sanskaraha, anya, sanskara, pratibandhi. So again, the meaning, the words are tajjaha, sanskaraha, anya sanskara pratibandhi. Alright, that's the sutra here. So, everything that we think of, everything that we do, creates a sanskara. Everyone knows that. What's a sanskara? An impression in the mind. So, we eat something, we create a sanskara. You're hearing this talk now, you'll create a sanskara. You go outside, you'll get a sanskara. Everything creates a sanskara. Right? So, what it says is that even this state of being where you have attained a very pure wisdom will create a sanskara in the mind. Okay? Even that will create a sanskara. But the beauty of that sanskara, he says, that it is anya sanskara pratibandhi. It will
eliminate,
it will subdue all the other sanskaras. That's the beauty of this sanskara. You do this repeatedly, it will start eliminating the past other impressions that bother us all the time. Past impressions create all kinds of problems. That's the whole purpose of yoga, is to eliminate all the sanskaras, because they create the problems. Sanskaras are the problem creators.
But don't the sanskaras also make us who we are?
That's exactly right. That's why we have problem. Because we who we are, we think we are the best. Nobody equals me. That's the problem. That's why it's called ahankara.
I am who I am.
I own this. I do this. I. That's what it comes out. So, what it says is that the sanskara that is produced by this final state of samadhi, it's very effective in subduing other sanskaras slowly. It takes time, obviously. It won't happen overnight.
How does that reconcile with the self-realization?
That's what is happening now. Eventually, when all the sanskaras are eliminated, then you start realizing what your true identity is. Otherwise, sanskaras take over. They are so powerful that the ahankara or the ego loves that. Ego loves to deal with the sanskaras and bring up stuff from the past. It will not allow you to understand who you are. But at this point, when this pure wisdom that we have attained now, Prajna, we have eliminated the negative influence of the sanskaras, and I have now come to realize what my true identity is. I'm not identifying with the ego anymore. That's called self-realization.
So basically, eliminating everything about you, making yourself one with nature. I mean,
with yourself, making one with the true self eventually. Then all that remains is just the memory, not the sanskaras. See, a quick example is, you know, we have this meeting, right? You know, so you go home and then a sanskara is already created in the mind. But what the ego does, it will put a label on it. I liked the meeting, I hated the meeting. I want to go back again, I'll never go back again.
What are you thinking about other students? Like I was better, or I knew more, or things.
See,
like that. So self-realization.
Those are the things which get attached to the memory.
Yeah. So self-realization is not that I realize that these are my weaknesses, these are my positive. It's not that, it's beyond that. It's realizing it's not your physical self. It's your true self is like that.
There you are.
Or, you know, you are one with nature. Is everything is going to, we are going to leave behind that kind of realization where nothing matters around you. So you are in oneness with God or the nature or whatever you believe in.
Okay. So the impression produced by this samadhi, it, well, wipes out is a little too strong, I think. Impressions are never wiped out. They are subdued. They become ineffective. They become dagdha bija. That's the word used by Vyasa. Dagdha bija. Dagdha means burnt out. Bija means the seed. They are there. They are as if they have been burnt out. That means they will never bring any more sprouts. That's the purpose of this whole discussion. Okay, so now when even that sanskar, the whole purpose of the yoga practice is to eventually get into the nirbija samadhi, no seed. So even when the sanskara of this pure wisdom is eliminated, it's suppressed, that's the final state of home run. Perfect.
It's like having basically nothing.
Absolutely nothing in the mind. That's the total state of emptiness. That's what the Buddhists call complete emptiness, right? They don't call nirvana, you know, nirvana is that state in Buddhist terms, when you have attained that state. Nothingness in the mind. Nirbija samadhi. Nothing in the mind.
I read something about Sikh gurus, you know, that, you know, how that Sikh gurus, you know, they were cut, they were burned, and, you know, all these things when the Sikhism was coming, you know, in the scriptures. I read the interpretation somewhere. Because of this, we think they went through so much of pain, right, when they were getting butchered or beheaded, right? But they have attained a state of where they don't feel a thing,
mm-hmm.
a state of true samadhi.
Yes.
Even though the person's inflicting pain on them, they think, oh my gosh, you know, we are doing what, you know, oh, they are getting happiness out of it, right, by inflicting pain. But these gurus, right, they have attained a, you know, samadhi, where they don't feel anything.
Very good.
You know, when they are inflicting pain on them or stuff like that. There was, I don't know where I read it, but it was an interpretation of.
That's very true. Very
right?
good.
Yeah. All these gurus and.
You know, there are some monks in Nepal also who can just sit and be burned with no. They don't show the pain or anything. They just burn and they just mm-hmm. because of, I guess.
Yeah, the same state. Yeah. I mean, Paramahansa Ramakrishna, for example, you know, he went through all kinds of physical pain. He had cancer and throat cancer and all that, but he never suffered. He never had any complaint or anything. He said it's okay.
They're beyond that suffering.
You know, Ramana Maharishi was the same way. I mean, he died fairly young, right? But he had no pain whatsoever of any kind, despite all these physical stuff that he was going through. Never. Okay, so that's the final state of Nirbija Samadhi. All right?